This podcast was made possible by an anonymous Irvingtonian and by our primary sponsor, Artisan Realtors, your Irvington real estate source.
Another edition of Firehouse Irvington. We find ourselves this time around in the friendly confines of the Black Acre Brewery. It was just a week ago that we were celebrating Halloween Fest, and it turned out to be just an absolutely rainy and miserable affair. But things do keep going on in Irvington, and of course we'll talk about spooky things and Halloween things moving forward, but disappointing for the good people of Irvington. We always talk about that Irvington is a state of mind, and this is a show about connections. And sometimes you don't always know, as you look at the world at large, you think the world is a very large place, but actually, in fact, the world is a very small place. So if you take a great neighborhood like Irvington and make those connections, it makes your life so much richer. And thank you for joining us here on Firehouse Irvington. Our guest today is a man affectionately known as Dr. Dave, Dave Brokaw. He's a man who's an orthopedic surgeon and is a good citizen of Irvington. And Dave, you blend right in. I wouldn't have guessed just from seeing you walk by, hey, there goes one of the best orthopedic guys in Indy.
Well, it's part of my mantra. It's to keep that secret side of myself, you know, out there. But no, that's my day job, and kind of what you see is what you get. I try not to have any pretenses. So
no, I think that's very cool. How long have you lived in Irvington?
We moved here in 1987 or 88. I was in medical school at the time, transitioning into residency. I'd been married for a year or two, and my wife and I spent 3 or 4 months looking through all different neighborhoods that was within driving distance of the Med Center, and went through Butler Tarkington, went through Brownsburg, and the last place we went to was Irvington, and I fell in love with it. The last house we looked at on 402 North Arlington was the house that I wish we'd seen at the very beginning, because we said this is it. It was sort of predestined to happen, and so we saw it, we loved it. We didn't have kids at the time, and my wife and I said, well, this is great. It's got a big yard, and that was the Irvington confines is what got us interested in the first place. I just really enjoyed it. So we've been here ever since 1988. So.
Well, it's a very distinctive place, as you know. And then after you move in and then become a resident of Irvington, what was the one thing that absolutely delighted you that you weren't expecting?
Well, other than just sort of the older traditional neighborhood, it was a circle of friends that we generated immediately thereafter. We kind of dove in with both feet, and we're Catholic, and so we got involved with the Catholic parish, and through that, we got to know a very close group of friends who we call it the playgroup moms. All of our wives were having children at the same time, and they would meet on a specific day at the parish center, and half of them would stay back and take care of the children at the time. The other half would get to go do what they wanted to, had some time off. And through that, I got to know all the husbands. Through that, and that's been sort of the glue for us here, you know. Never wanted to leave the confines since 1988, because essentially there's 5 or 6 families who there's been 12 parents raising 25 kids, we say. So
yeah, you know. Well, and then, you know, so many great cities are built on great neighborhoods, and I think this underscores, if you get into that great neighborhood feel, you almost don't want to leave it, because it's like a little, you know, bosom or womb, you know?
Exactly. And it's grown. When we moved here in 88, there wasn't Black Acres. There wasn't the fun places to go. There wasn't the exciting places. And despite not having that, it still had that vibe for, it was a place we wanted to raise our kids, and have our family, and it's been proven to be that way. Now having places like where we're sitting right now, it's huge. it's so much fun, and it's sort of like that diner. One of my partners says the secret of civilization. His ancestry is Greek. He says the secret of civilization in any town is to have a family-owned Greek diner. And you can just kind of picture the feel of
that's
that.
So cool, yeah.
And you come to Black Acres, you kind of feel like it's a Greek diner sort of feeling. It's
absolutely. Yeah. And I've always felt, too, you know, that in England, more so than here in the United States, they've always had that thought process of the public house, meaning a place you can pop in, grab a pint, and kind of catch up with your friends. And I think Black Acre provides that. And as you said, you wouldn't have guessed that some place like the Black Acre would have enhanced the neighborhood that much.
It was like a light switch. It was, I remember hearing the sort of the buzz that there may be a pub opening up down there, and the attention was immediate, and it was a sense of urgency that it opened, and I don't remember the first time I was here, but I just remember like, yeah, this is cool. It's similar to the town when I took a year off to do a fellowship out in Seattle. And Seattle has some of the same kind of older neighborhoods that have maintained connectivity, and so it was a natural addition to what we already had here from 1988. So
now, have you always had an interest in beer?
Yes.
Well, I mean,
and how much time do you have?
Well, and I unabashedly do as well, but I think it's kind of fun because you can be into beer and then not be perceived as you're some kind of guy that's, you know, sneaking around the back drinking Listerine, you know, to
right.
cop a buzz.
Right.
It's a very social and sociable beverage.
I agree. And my intro into drinking beer was college, and I promised my football coach in high school that I wouldn't consume any alcoholic beverages, and I kept my word on that until the day I graduated. But and then when I went to university, that it became a social lubricant, you know.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And I've enjoyed it ever since, and I love it. I love this transition now into this the microbreweries and the niche market that's associated with the brewing, and I love, I'm a Miller High Life guy, and my good friend Kirk has been teaching me some different tasting variables of the IPAs, but I just think it's cool to be able to go into a bar now or a pub, and you can look at the menu, and it has the IBU and the everything else you're looking for, and you can kind of pick and choose to say, I'm going to try something different today, and then when I go home, I open my refrigerator, there's Miller High Life's in it. But
Well, you have to have the tried and true, and the word always was America grew up on lager beer, mm-hmm. so lager is a style of beer, and we really didn't have anything other than lagers to select from until about 1994 or 95. When some of the first brew pubs arrived. So it's not like we've had this long, rich history of microbrewing. In
Correct.
Fact, only in the past 15 years has it really emerged as, you know, something that's viable.
I agree with you. In context, when I was telling you I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship out in Seattle, and that was the epicenter of the microbreweries out there, the Sierra Nevadas, I can't think of all the earliest ones, but that was starting in the sort of the downtown urban area of Seattle. And I thought it was cool then, and I thought this is going to be a flash in the pan. That was 1993.
Right.
Fast forward, you know, to 2016 in the state of Indiana. I can't remember the exact details, but within a 50-mile radius, there's like 80 new breweries, microbreweries or niche breweries. There are people that are malting barley just for the distillation crafts, and it's in Boone County, Indiana, and it's just huge. So what I thought was a flash in the pan back in 1993, it's still an engine that's running, that's got steam behind it, and people, you know, how can you not, you know, grab a hold of the the beer train and write that.
Absolutely. In fact, we were lobbying hard to make sure that we conducted this interview at the Black Acres. So I thought you'd enjoy the ambiance and the pint.
It was amazing, major negotiating point. I think it was well played, well played.
We can't get Dr. Dave out of the house unless we promise him a delicious beer.
Or at least the chance thereof. So.
Now, one of the things that our producer, Kevin, talked about when we were setting this up is not only am I fascinated by the craft brewing industry because we could delve into the history and, you know, the number of brewers that were around pre-Prohibition, post-Prohibition, and then ironically, the brewers hit a big skid in the 60s and 70s because they came up against these monopolies of beer owners. So these big beer companies oftentimes put the regional beer companies out of business. So that's its own story. But throughout this whole thing is you need a specific ingredient to brew beer, and one of those is hops.
Correct.
And the fact that you're associated with a hops farm, I find fascinating.
Well, thanks. It excites me. It's one of those things that I wake up in the morning thinking about how to make it better. I go to bed at night trying to think how to make it better and how to make it work well. And it started, believe it or not, in Black Acres, and it was the fall of 2016. And I think Kirk and some of our friends that were part of that playgroup moms, we were here. As it started getting cold, we said, let's find a Thursday evening and go someplace. And this was a place we'd go. We'd just come back and reconnect. And this is at a time when some guys were retiring, some guys, you know, were transitioning. We were increasing our friend circle. And so we're sitting over there, and I get a phone call. And one of my pet peeves is not to have a phone call or answer a phone call while you're having either a business or a social event, you know.
Right.
So I felt a little embarrassed that I had my phone ringer on. So I was picking the phone up just to turn it off when I recognized the caller calling me. And it was an association from my day job, orthopedic surgery. I said, well, I probably ought to take this. And thinking it was some sort of medical problem. But it was a patient of mine who I'd been taking care of for 5 or 6 years, said, hey, you want to get involved with a hops farm? And
was that the opening line? Because that would have been great.
I'm paraphrasing, but sure. But I was trying to announce in my tenor on the telephone that you got a few seconds to make, you know, tell me what you need because I'm going to hang up the phone. And
right.
And so the first couple words somewhere says, hey, we've got this hop farm, and I know you have other farming adventures and want to know if you'd be interested in it. And I said, sure, I'll call you back. And so I hung up the phone, and we finished our Thursday evening, you know, get together here, and went home and got ready for our Friday at work. And so I just kept going in the back of my mind, what is this? What's Josh talking about? What's he talking about? I'd heard nothing about it from anywhere. And so I followed up, and that was in the fall of 2016. And now I'm a major owner of Crazy Horse Hops in Knightstown, what started as an interest with a previous patient of mine who's a professional farmer turned into we're now one of the largest hops producers in the Midwest, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota are large producers of hops, and as a niche agribusiness, and that's kind of my other interest is to be a good steward of the earth. The people that were involved with this were good stewards of the earth and started something from the ground up with the idea that it's hard to make a living selling corn and beans on a commodity market. Let's do something different.
Sure.
And
let's do something that's potentially fun because this is a crop
it's
that's
beer.
Turned into something delicious.
Yeah, it's beer. Yeah.
Yeah, you're making beer.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, it's funny. Everyone's got to have quirky habits, and I'm really into history. So I got a chance to work radio in the greater Cincinnati area, and there was a fascinating history of canals in Ohio. So I'd tramp around in the woods, you know. And,
oh, fantastic.
Try to find these old canal locks and things like that, and I'd drag my daughter along. So I always felt like if you saw a middle-aged guy and his daughter tramped around on your farmland, you wouldn't be intimidated like, you know, somebody's trying to steal something.
No, I say, well, what can we do to make this connection here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always felt like, you know, at least I was giving the friendliest front I could. And I bumped into a guy, and he showed me part of where the canal went and the canal keeper's house. But the reason why I bring this up was he said the real history of this place is the fact that this was one of the largest hops farms in Southwest Ohio. And he said the soil lent itself to hops production. And he said there was so much German brewing going on in Cincinnati that they needed hops by the train car load. And he goes, this, if you stood in the middle of this field, he goes, you just only saw hops to the horizon in all four directions. And I became fascinated by that, that a crop like that could have been so prevalent, yet then just completely disappeared over the years because obviously the big brewers went to other sources of hops.
Correct. The soils in the Ohio Valley have what's known as a terroir of the appropriate minerals that's equivalent to where they were started. We have a good growing season that has a winter kill that would kill a lot of the disease and parasites that would otherwise damage crops.
Right.
And so that's one of the reasons why the hops industry has grown here. The 800-pound gorilla is in Yakima Valley, Washington.
Okay.
And so they're the ones that migrated west after Prohibition and opened these large farms. And they're large industrial farms, thousands of acres and mechanical processing, and they sell by the train car instead of by the 10-kilo bag. And so that's the major producer. And like any commodity, you know, if you're AmBev or Anheuser-Busch or any of the other large, you know, purveyors, well, you buy, you know, tremendous amounts, and then the smaller brewers don't always have that opportunity to get that.
Right.
So the niche market we're trying to break into and support is to support those 50 new brewers that develop every 2 years. It's almost like a guild. It's not a big industry. It's a guild where, you know, if a brewer's down on his luck or a piece of machinery goes down or they're out of hops or barley, someone else loans it to them until they can get up to speed. And I think that's a very civil way of doing business, and it kind of feeds into that, you know, the good stewardship of the land kind of deal. So,
well, I've been fortunate in my line of work to meet a lot of the brewers, and I don't think I've met a bad brewer yet. They're pretty down-to-earth people. There's just something that draws people to beer production that it almost like self, I don't know, what's the right word for it, that they've taken all the bad guys out. It's only good guys that brew beer. It seems to be that way.
Yeah, there's a civility to it. I that's kind of one of my main words is the thing should be civil. And talk about Cincinnati, one of the large producers down there, or not large producers, but the people. It's Rheingeist, and that started 7 years ago by a bunch of, you know, small brewers that took over some of the old German brew houses down in over the Rhine in Cincinnati, and it's phenomenal what they're doing down there. Well, now they buy our hops. So.
And they've become the number one Midwest beer producer. They have done so well, and so many people enjoy Rheingeist that they have become the number one local. I saw that just
that's
within
new,
the last
that's
year.
Great, yeah.
So, yeah.
And they deserve it because they've done it right. They're one of the first larger brewers that kind of we got their attention. I guess it's that way around, and that's that we sort of developed that relationship, and it's a very fruitful and a very, you know, cooperative relationship. They're purchasers of our wet hops,
right?
And they like to do a fall wet hops brew, and so that's one of the commodities that we're able to do here in the Midwest. Because by definition, it has to be in the brew pot within 24 or 48 hours. So you can't pick it in Yakima unless you put it on a FedEx plane and it costs you $10,000 to ship it. So we can put it in the back of my pickup truck and drive it to Rheingeist and have a few pints with them, drink some Truth.
And in your line of work, you're familiar with a medical emergency. So if you were stopped at any time, you could claim this is a medical emergency.
Absolutely.
Because A, I'm a physician, and B, I'm a hops producer, and this has to get to the brewery.
And Jay, I have history that that's been done, and it does work. Yeah.
I think what a lot of people may not realize, okay, we have a patch of land, and as you said, some of the soils around here would support hops production. But hops is a very interesting crop, and once again, I am not a farmer, but it's one of the few crops that is vertical in nature. You guys have to grow hops up, and therefore you actually have to have some equipment that provides something
lots
for the vines
right.
to lock onto.
Right. It's a perennial plant. It's a shrub. It doesn't, in nature, it can grow vertically or horizontally. It's grown horizontally commercially to make it easy to pick.
Okay.
So they train it, or we train it on sisal twine, or it's really palm frond twine. And so an acre of ground for a hops field or a hops yard, it's about $15,000 per acre to install it. That's a pole every 100 feet, and those poles are, you know, $80 or $90 a piece. There's a quarter-inch aircraft stainless steel cable you have to put in between. You put the drain tile and we use what's called fertigation, mm-hmm. Which is irrigation, underground irrigation piping that takes both soluble nutrients and the water to them. So we can, that's a variable that we can control.
Right.
And we can control everything now except for the pests and the weather. And so for ease of harvest, they're grown up on it's called a bine. And it's an interesting fact of nature that they will only grow clockwise. So in the spring, you go out with a bunch of friends, and you have to take these plants and you twist them two or three times around this twine that you have to replace every year. And if you twist them counterclockwise, the plant will die. It's just a fascinating, you know, piece of botany. So you go around, and so these grow, and at the end of the summer, it looks like looks like small pine cones, and that's the carrier of the hops. That's
right.
the hop cone, and it's the cultivation is similar to what you do for corn and beans, as far as, you know, weed control and pest control, and then in the fall we have a machine. It's a picker. It looks like a customized or modified regular row crop tractor that has a cutter up top, so it goes down these rows and it cuts the vine and the twine at the bottom with like a sickle bar, and it cuts the same up top. And between these cables, it's barbed wire. And if you just think of barbed wire, that every 8 inches there's a star shape.
Right.
That is a functional or it's a physical stop that creates the friction that to cause these to break off and fall to the ground. And then we capture those 20-foot long cords, and then those are taken from the field into we have a USDA production facility where they go into it's called a hops harvester, and just picture a John Deere combine without wheels. It's sitting
right
on the floor, and it picks these, and through a mixture of differential wind-directed or air-directed blowers, friction from little rubber wheels that hit the vines. You separate essentially the wheat from the chaff, the cones that come up the conveyor, and then the rest gets sent out to a compost pile. And then a place like Rheingeist or Black Acres or Sun King, Three Floyds, those are places to come. They will buy those cones for wet hops.
Okay.
And then those have a shelf life of a week. And then the rest of the time we put them in dry hops, dry cones. We have a device that's a dryer. It's called an oast. And they're dried down to 14% moisture, so they'll stay without mold. And then in the winter when there's nothing to do, we pelletize those. So we
okay.
put it looks like little rabbit food.
I was going to say, most people that have seen some brewery operations might have noticed these green rabbit pellets.
Right.
Those are not rabbit food. Those are
no,
actually hops. Yeah,
yeah, they're tasty little morsels of a loving beer commodity.
It's,
yeah,
it's solids that will be made into beer later.
Correct.
So don't
Correct.
Worry, citizens. We're going
right.
to do something good with this.
Right.
So I guess really what you're saying, there's a lot to this. So my guess is this started off as an innocent hobby, or perhaps, you know, somebody said, hey, you want to toss in a few bucks on this? But there's an awful lot to this, and I'm impressed kind of where you've gone with this.
Yeah, it's the speed of advancement has really been unique. We're 3 years into a five-year prospectus, and we're on goal. I have to admit, I'm like a producer in a movie. I provide resources of cash and loans in order to fund it. I don't have a lot of knowledge or experience in planting the hops, but I get out there when I can, and we have some very talented men. It did start as a hobby. It was a quarter acre plot in Knightstown that they said, I'm going to do this, and brew my own beer, and then the family that owns the farm ground where our farm is now, they're going like, I can make $8,000 per acre on corn or beans, or I can make, you know, $200,000 on hops. So there, it's an attempt in the family to increase farm production, farm income, and a niche business that no one else can kind of handle. So there's the cool part of it, and the guild and the civility of brewing beer and making hops, and then there's the financial realities of a family farmer in central Indiana is trying to make their farm stay for the next generation.
Well, you raise a great point about stewardship of the land, and we obviously have an amazing heritage of great farmers here in the state of Indiana, and we're always... If you read one thing about food supply, you have to worry a tiny bit about what they call monoculture. We live in a state where there's an awful lot of corn and soybeans grown because those are commodities.
Correct.
But as you said, if farmers want to try to make a living, it's kind of interesting that they have a chance to try a stab at some other plants. And I think that that's really cool that hops became popular at a time when farmers actually needed other avenues to try to make a living.
Absolutely. In central Indiana, the other big one is barley, where you grow it like wheat, but to malt barley, you have to heat it and moisten it, and it sprouts, and then you kill it by drying it again, and that changes the carbohydrate pattern, and it can be malted into the support for beer brewing, and that's in Thorntown, Indiana, so it's very local. So, yeah.
So as you drive through the state of Indiana, keep your eyes open for barley and hops. And I'm going to guess if you just drove by a hops farm, it looks somewhat vineyard-like because there's these orderly rows and.
Yeah, it's a vineyard on acid. Yeah, it's and what you look above us looks like these look like hop cones, but the poles are 30 feet tall. And there's kind of a feng shui to it. It's a very ordered, diagonal and a very exact production. It looks like an architect put it in there. But yes, it's the 30-foot tall poles when you try to get 20 feet of hops vines growing up, and it's beautiful. You get to watch them kind of you just twirl them around the sisal twines, and they just grow themselves up. And
that's fascinating. Yeah. Now, you know, I've gotten everywhere I've ever gotten in life by inviting myself to things, so I would love to come out and actually see the operation.
Oh, we'd love to have you. We had hoped to if our schedules would have met, we wanted to have you guys out there during harvest, and we wanted to have you out there, you know, getting your hands dirty and then having the podcast there. And I still guarantee that we'll make that work.
Good. I'd love to see that.
And because the people there that are involved are good people, and they are passionate, and they're doing the right thing, and we think, you know, in the near future, this is going to prove right, that it's going to be a supportive, you know, niche farming operation that other farmers can go into. That's one of our business models, is that we've developed this large production facility. So if, you know, we have 128 acres, I believe now, which is the largest one. But if you're growing an acre of hops, you can make some very good hops, but you may not have the cash reserves to process it. So
right.
We want to be able to provide processing from that for smaller farmers, and in order to allow them to have a successful business too, and also to support our business by having a contractual relationship to do the processing. So
gentleman farmer, both a hobby and a business for you, and your day job involves orthopedic surgery, correct?
Yes, I would say I'm the kind of guy you don't want to have to come see. I'm an orthopedic traumatologist. I've spent the last 32 years taking care of people that are involved in motor vehicle accidents, gunshot wounds, falls from heights. I try to be there on the worst day of your life.
Right,
you know,
absolutely.
And that's what has been my passion for 32 years. And as I slow down a little bit, that's where I've had the opportunity to kind of branch out into these other interests. So, but that's my day job, and I still do it. I do what's called cold trauma now, where instead of being up, I always said I spent 30 years of my life sleeping in pajamas, i.e. scrubs, in my office, which I had a sofa, and spent 4-5 nights a month away from my family waiting for the pager to go off.
Right.
And so I'm glad that's behind me. I'm glad I did it. I've always pinched myself that I'm the luckiest man in the world to be able to do that. But, it's a time in my life where I have some other interests that I want to.
Well, they always say that the measure is how well we sometimes help others. So you've helped others in the dark moments of their lives when they have shattered bones. And then for a disc jockey like myself who needs a glass of beer, you've been there to provide the hops. So let's not minimize your contribution to America and society at large.
I like to give till it hurts. So.
Absolutely. Well, this is delightful. I guess the only other question we usually ask Irvingtonians is your house haunted, and have you met the ghost?
Our house is not haunted that I know of. What I thought was a haunting was just a old cranky a furnace that the haunting went away when I got dial one heating and cooling in. That's one of the interesting parts of Irvington is the association with Halloween and October and the hauntings and so that was another fun part of growing up in Irvington is the Brokaws and the Friedleys competing in the getting their children's costumes for the Halloween festival in first, second, or third place, and it was a very friendly competition. But I think we're up 5-4.
Oh. We'll have to check the official results.
This beer may have altered my perception of.
It's. Yeah. Well, and as you've said about the hauntings, I'd always felt like in life I knew better, but growing up here on the east side of town, the worst I've ever spooked myself was walking just past Pleasant Run Golf Course, and it was about 10 o'clock at night, and I literally was out for a walk because somebody was yelling at me, hey, you got to drop some pounds. So I thought, well, do a little walking,
you know?
And heard some of the strangest noises I've ever heard.
Really?
So I ended up jogging home.
There you go. See, it worked.
Perhaps running in stretches. Yes. So ironically, the spooks, then the ghosts and goblins said, hey, you do need to shed a few pounds.
I've heard that same voice in my head. But you remember the scene in my favorite movie of all time is To Kill a Mockingbird, and that one scene where the kids, Jim and Scout, were coming back from the Halloween costume and they're walking down the street and they get accosted by the I can't remember the guy's name that was the wielding the knife, and Boo Radley comes out and stops. And if you think about that, if you just think of the environment that was filmed, that's Irvington. That's a sidewalk in Irvington, and so every time I see that scene in To Kill a Mockingbird, I think of, yeah, it's that Halloween festival at Irvington.
That is Irvington. Well, Dr. Dave Broco has been our guest. I'm so glad you stopped by. We both got to share a pint here at the Black Acre, so we proved our point about the whole conviviality of meeting over a pint of beer. I'm glad you shared your stories. I'm going to guess there's plenty more untapped stories, so we'd like to have you on again. And
I'd love to do that.
We need to be out at the actual hops operation. There's some little things I didn't know the counter, or is it clockwise that the plants grow?
They grow clockwise. It's called phototropism. The terminal buds on the top of the plant seek sunlight, and they seek sunlight by creating a hydraulic action in the tendril that climbs clockwise only.
So even the hops have this sense of, we got to hurry up and become good hops because we're going to be made into beer.
Right. The top of the pole is their beer.
That's cool.
They seek that.
Well, the whole thing is fascinating. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing your stories. We'd also like to thank Artisan Realtors. They're located here not too far away from the Black Acre. In fact, you could probably meet with Dan from Artisan Realtors, and he'd probably share a beer with you while you talk about letting Artisan Realtors craft a great deal for you so you too can move into Irvington. We heard last weekend that there's actually sort of a shortage of homes, that so many people want to move into this community. So
it's great. It's a fun community, and not a single day have I ever regretted moving here. I've 1988 and to today, it's bigger and better every year. It's
great.
A fun place.
So definitely visit Artisan Realtors and have them make sure that you can find the perfect home here in the greater Irvington area. I'd like to thank the Black Acre. I'd like to thank Kevin. I'd like to thank Dan Adams and our guest, Dr. Dave Brokaw. It's been an outstanding edition of Firehouse Irvington. We'll be in your neighborhood soon, especially if you have beer. And we do love the connections, and we appreciate all that have joined us here on Firehouse Irvington. Until next time, be kind.